I'd like now to welcome Andrew Hassey. He is founder of East Bay Pictures and director of the documentary film Edible City, which screens tonight at the Santa Fe Farmers Market. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. It's a terrific documentary, and it's basically about people who have decided that rather than fighting the food system and the Monsantos and the junk food on their territory, they would just carve out their own territory and do their own food production. How did you come to this whole subject?
Well, when we started making the film in 2008, there were already some films coming out that did a really great job of describing what the problems were. So Future of Food had already come out, and Food Inc. was just about to come out. And we thought that they did a great job at digging pretty deep into the broken food system. But what was missing was what the solutions were. You know, what are the answers? What do you do when you walk away from a movie knowing, understanding what the problems are? What do you do next?
And there were all sorts of people. There are all sorts of people all over the country doing precisely that. And it turns out a lot of them are in cities. I mean, you focus on the Bay Area. Is that where you live, and is that where you are from?
Yeah, I'm from Berkeley originally. I grew up here, and then went to school in New York, but came back to work and live. And the decision to focus on the Bay Area eventually came just because we thought it would be most interesting to look at what a community was doing in one place. Because there are, amazing efforts all over the place. And since we started the film, more and more and more. But just getting to know a group of people in one place, and actually the way that we met a lot of the characters who ended up in the film was just through word of mouth. We would ask one person, who should we talk to? And then we get another name and so on. And so that's sort of how we met everybody.
And so what were they doing?
Well, the film focuses on about 10 different people. And they're all working in sort of different levels of the food system. And so we have a backyard farmer who's sort of, just doing it for himself and his family and smaller community. We have people that are organizing neighborhoods and doing community gardens and community farm stands. We have chefs and educators who are serving kind of a wider community. And then activists and policymakers who are, working nationally and internationally as well.
One of the things that I think is really interesting about this film is that when people take on urban farming and, I mean, whatever scale it is, but they start doing it and bringing people together, not only do they start eating fresh food and everything, but it actually changes the community for the better. Can you describe some of those places?
Yeah, that was one of the things that really struck me initially. To go back a little bit and to answer your first question again, I was working initially on a documentary about climate change that was based on a book by a couple authors in Oakland, and called Breakthrough. And it was really interesting to me, and I thought it would make a good movie. But as I got deeper into it, I realized that everything in the world of climate change was on such an enormous level and so inaccessible to individuals that it was a little bit depressing. And that when I looked at what people were doing with food and urban agriculture and changing the local food system, it was so much more tangible and hands-on, and the benefits were really evident on the personal level in terms of health, and then on the community level in terms of cohesion and engagement. And also growing local economies. That was something that really started to become more and more important as we learn more. And as the movement has grown, I think the dimension of entrepreneurship and growing economic resilience is kind of central to the whole idea of good food systems.
And that's one of the reasons that it's so interesting where you've got these, working class Black and Latino communities coming together with these kind of anarchist punk Occupy types. And it seems to be, I don't know what it was like on the ground, maybe you could tell us, but it seems to be a kind of natural fit in a way that you might not have guessed.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody eats, as one of the characters in the film says, and so it's a topic that brings everybody to the table, and everybody's coming from a different background, and potentially for different reasons, but ultimately everybody's looking for the same thing, which is to have, you know, good and affordable and socially just food available and food systems that can really help grow local economies. So it was fascinating to see the kind of interactions that would happen between, you know, advocates and activists and local community members and entrepreneurs and investors and then the policy people. And, you know, there's a good amount of coordination that's going on, and there could also be a lot more. And also, I think through making the film, we got to even help encourage some interaction and cross-pollination, which is something I'm still continuing to try to do with the film, both around here in the Bay Area and also nationally and around the world, actually.
Yeah, I mean, we're watching it tonight here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where we have farmers markets and local farming, and it's part of the dialogue of this city. One of the things that was cool was there was a guy there who was talking on your film who was talking about what had happened in Cuba during the so-called special period, the post-Soviet Union period, where there was tremendous food and petroleum shortages in Cuba, and they started doing all this urban gardening, which produced vast amounts of food in Cuba. And the old-timers were teaching the young people, because, of course, the old-timers were the original farmers who farmed in organic methods because there wasn't anything else. Do we have that happening here?
I think there's a real resurgence of interest in agriculture, both urban agriculture, but also, in rural areas from young people. And I think that connecting the farmers that have a lot of experience and can teach young people with those that are really looking to learn is one of the most important things that can be done now. And the project that I'm working on right now, that's sort of an extension of Edible City, is I'm hoping we'll do some of that. But I'm really constantly surprised and impressed and just wowed by the young people that I meet. And their enthusiasm to learn some of these skills that are, might be forgotten if they weren't learning them now. And I'm always really interested to meet, experienced farmers who want to share their knowledge, because there's so much wisdom that, we just don't want to lose.
And it's wisdom that is really lost when you have mechanized monoculture farming.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, because in Cuba, like you said, there was a conversion to the Green Revolution industrial agriculture style, like we have here, but it hadn't been in place for as long as we have had now. And so there is a danger in this country of that wisdom being lost. But unfortunately, also, people here, I think, are really aware of that. And so, it's a small group of people, but they're really passionate about, seed saving and sharing techniques and technologies that are not mechanized. And there's also, I think, going to be more and more cross-pollination, if you will, in terms of ideas between here and South America and other parts of the world, because there's a lot going on, especially in parts of South America that we can learn a lot from up here.
Well, that's another point that I thought was very important that the film made, without pushing it very hard, and there could be a lot more said about this, namely that there's this kind of ongoing attitude that the Northern Hemisphere has a great deal to teach the Southern Hemisphere, but it doesn't really go the other direction. So what is some of the kind of knowledge and wisdom that is coming from this in our hemisphere, South America, Latin America, to the U.S.?
That's a good question, and there's a lot to be learned, everything from cultivating new types of, or actually old types of, grains and other kind of edible plants that are coming from places like Peru and Ecuador and all over, so ways of raising new kinds of food, but also ways of organizing communities. There's a professor of agroecology at UC Berkeley named Miguel Altieri, and he's featured in the film. And he's a real expert on the ways that people in Brazil and Venezuela and Argentina and all over South America are organizing to change their food systems, and particularly in Brazil with something called the MST, which is an organization of landless peasants who basically started to take over, unoccupy, if you will, land that was not being used and just started to farm it. And they have organized, I think, around 10 million people around this idea of taking back land and starting to make it active in agriculture again. And it's much more fully baked than the Occupy we have here. You know, they are really smart about the way they organize, and they really are organizing around community health. And a lot of the way that they certify their farms and the way they distribute the food, and it's a whole economy that we could learn from. That's much more democratic and also functional than our food system.
Somebody in your film says, and by the way, we're talking to Andrew Hassie about the film Edible City. Somebody in the film says, change happens when you confront crisis. And I was wondering, I mean, it's a kind of interesting moment because it's almost like we're not quite at that crisis yet, but everybody kind of smells it coming and they're doing the changes now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's Miguel Altieri, actually, who says that. And I think he has seen firsthand, in other parts of the world, what happens when especially in Cuba, for example, when crisis hits. And I think it's true that people here are just starting to really wake up to the fact that the food system is broken in a lot of ways. It's unhealthy, but it's also really fragile, mainly because it depends so much on fossil fuel for all the fertilizing pesticides and transportation. And so it's so centralized right now. There's, you know, the food is grown mainly in a few areas and then shipped to just a few areas to get processed and then shipped out again to all over. And that, you know, just at huge expense of oil and gas and everything, that it's not really very resilient in terms of if there were some kind of an economic shock or an oil shock or a climate shock. So I think people are starting to become more aware of that and starting to plan more around that. And, you know, I think I started really from a place of having some fear around those kind of disruptions in the food system. And I think it's worth being a little bit worried about, because that does motivate people. But I also now really try to focus on the solutions and on how changing the system now can benefit us, not just in the long term in terms of protecting the validity of the food system, but also in terms of building economies in the immediate future. You know, you can change so much a community by putting in investing in and starting a local food store on a corner, and, you know, replacing a liquor store with a local food store that can just revitalize an entire community. And so it's true that there is a lot of danger right now around the current food system. And I also think that the way to encourage people to change more rapidly is to show them the positive outcomes that could happen.
So in your film, there are folks talking about starting a local food store, and they're sitting in some building that might be torn down, but it might not be, and it has, you know, shelves and freezers and things like that. Did that ever get off the ground?
Good question. That particular one did not, unfortunately, and it was made mainly because of the developers and also the city. There's a lot of red tape. But the folks who are in that scene and who are trying to make that happen have gone on to do other projects. There's a supermarket, a local, you know, food supermarket that's even larger, I believe, that's been fundraising for the last several years, and I believe it's just about to break ground. And then there have been other efforts in terms of growing local food and distributing it locally, not necessarily in liquor stores, but in other ways. So that's been one of the most interesting things, is to see, you know, where people hit roadblocks, and oftentimes it's because of, you know, local regulations, permits, things like that. and how they can maneuver around them and still the outcome they're looking for, but with a slightly different approach.
I read an article recently about the impact of rooftop solar panels on the utilities industry, and it basically said that rooftop by rooftop, they are chipping away at the utilities' economic model, basically their business model, to the point where if that industry doesn't change and change radically pretty quickly, it's not going to survive, which was fascinating because, I mean, every person who puts some little couple of panels on their roof and makes that investment doesn't feel like they're necessarily changing the whole system, but they are, and this really reminded me of that. Like, the more urban farming you have, the more the gigantic monocultures are actually probably or possibly threatened. I don't know. What's your take on that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting parallel. I think that in terms of food, you know, even in Cuba when they were in that crisis period and growing as much food as they could in the city, it's still not really possible to grow everything that you need for a city to feed itself. But if you include the peri-urban area or the area right around the city, that's when you really start to be able to feed, you know, whole populations. And so I think in terms of urban agriculture, it definitely takes the dent out of, you know, the fact that people are getting their food from far away if you start getting it from your own backyard or your neighbor's backyard or a rooftop garden or a community garden. But I think that, you know, maybe more importantly than as importantly as providing the food itself is it really shows people where their food is coming from. It reminds them, you know, your food comes from the ground. It's grown. There are people that grow it. And it's important to know that and to know where it comes from. And then by engaging people in that way, by having them see it and remember that, then they're more likely to go to the farmer's market or buy local from a local store, or, you know, it's about changing minds as much as filling bellies, you know.
Right, right. And it also, I have to say, does some stereotype busting. I mean, there's this idea that low-income people really like junk food and they want to eat McDonald's. And there's this scene where there's a room full of people and somebody's saying, how many of you cook your food at home? And they mostly raise their hands. How many of you would like to have fresh, healthy food? They all raise their hands. It's like it's not like there isn't a demand for this kind of food in poor communities. And it's really hard to understand why, and we know, we talk about food deserts, why there aren't supermarkets that sell healthy foods in poorer neighborhoods.
Yeah, it's a real misconception, and a lot of the work that was being done initially that we were following was about just doing the research and doing the community outreach and finding out, you know, is there really a demand for good food in neighborhoods that don't have it? And the answer is a resounding yes. And unfortunately, the reason that it's not available often is just economic, in that, you know, it's a little bit more expensive because of the current food system to have good local food available, and there's not as big of a return on investment for somebody who would be putting in a supermarket. Or, you know, I think a lot of times there are food deserts that are there because the supermarkets see that they can't, or think they can't make enough money there. Which is actually not true, and they've now, the Hope Collaborative, which is the scene that you were mentioning there, where they're asking everybody about whether they cook, they pretty much showed that there is plenty of money in a community like that that would be buying fresh produce. But it's, I think it's a little bit of, structural racism or there's a lot of factors, but it's definitely a myth that people want to be eating just junk food. It's really just that's all that's available a lot of the time.
In the film, and oddly enough, in another interview I did just a few days ago, I have had, in this film, it's the second example in a week of a single mother of a small child who is very unhealthy. Then she says, wait a minute, let's start feeding this child healthy food. And it's a complete transformation, and the child is healthy. And both cases, the mother's lives are transformed and they get really into healthy food. And I just think, you know, the other one was An Chi Minh, the Chinese author who was writing a memoir about her immigration to the United States. And she wanted to feed her child McDonald's because that was sort of the American dream. And then her child got really sick. And in your film, it's a black woman who basically cures her child. And doctors want to give her drugs and all this stuff. And you see these examples, and these are just two that have come across my desk in the last week. There must be millions of them and millions of children right now who would be healthy and who would not need medical treatment if their parents were feeding them healthy food.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest secrets that's in front of everybody's eyes in the country, is that so much of the ill health and is diet related. The processed foods and pesticides and chemical additives and all these things that are in probably 99% of the food that people eat are really poisoning us. And I think one of the hardest things is to see that, because it's so disturbing. It raises a lot of questions about why the food system is like this. Who is allowing it to be like this? You know, why aren't we being, as the public, why aren't we being protected by our government? And then it starts to unravel a lot of other questions about, you know, corporatize the government and, all kinds of things that are uncomfortable. And so I think that, you know, asking what is wrong with the food system actually just opens up a can of worms. And for a lot of people, it's maybe more than they want to think about at the moment. And so they just will continue to eat the way that we have all been told to eat. And it's not our fault. It's that, you know, there's been a huge amount of advertising dollars and, just billions of dollars poured into this machine to tell us what we should eat, which is often not what we should be eating.
Right. And what I love about the film is it, as you say, and this was your intention in the first place, it shows the positive side of it. It shows some of the solutions and doesn't really dwell on the problem. I don't even know if the word Monsanto is mentioned in the film, or it barely, if it is at all, it barely is. And the next set of questions that come up for people who are watching it and for the people in the film is, how do you make a new food system based on the kind of food systems that we see in the film, local agriculture and so on, that are long-term, that are stable, and that are larger scale without going into the corporate model? And those are some very important questions.
Yeah, they are. And I think the solution or the answers to the questions are still being worked out in a lot of ways, but there also are a lot of answers that exist. And, you know, for me as a filmmaker and a storyteller, I feel it's really important to find the story, the success stories, and to help share them and, you know, inspire other people to do similar things. So I think that's one way to start, is just to learn more about what's going on out there, you know, around the country, around the world. There's a lot of really inspiring models and people doing great stuff. And the folks in Edible City are just a small slice of those people. But there's so much that can inspire people to say, hey, you know, I can do things differently. And whether it's just, you know, planting a few herbs in your backyard, or a few vegetables in your backyard, or on your deck, or in your window, or just deciding that you want to go to the farmer's market and it's worth it to pay that little bit extra to get really good quality food and, you know, shake the farmer's hand and give them, put your money right into their hand instead of having it go through middlemen and other people that are going to dilute it. And, you know, voting with your fork, voting with your dollar, those are some really easy ways that people can make a difference. And I think also just helping to educate other people, because that's the biggest thing, is that we just need to change the story around what a good food system is. And it's not going to come from, you know, just criticizing what the problems are, although that's an important thing to be aware of. But it's going to come from sharing the success stories and sharing good food. You know, a lot of people don't even know what a what good food tastes like because they've never had it. So I think just sharing food with people is a great way of opening minds. And then the one thing that's there's some of it in the film, but I think it's really, really one of the most important things is the educating kids of all ages, because really, you know, these changes, cultural changes, take time, and it's really going to come from the kids who are in school gardens now, you know, and who are learning how to prepare foods in cooking classes and after school classes, you know, and they're the, oftentimes they bring what they learn home to their parents, and they say, you know, I learned about this at school, and this, it makes sense to me. It's important. I want to start eating better. I don't want to eat, you know, Doritos for lunch. I want to eat real food. So there's a really, you know, the value of educating kids is, I think, the most valuable, in my opinion.
Andrew Hassey is founder of East Bay Pictures and director of the documentary Edible City, which screens tonight at the Santa Fe Farmers Market. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks again so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And the screening is at 7 o'clock tonight. For more information, you can go to farmersmarketinstitute.org. I'm very happy now to welcome Sean Murphy. He's author of the new book, One Bird, One Stone, 108 Contemporary Zen Stories, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore this evening at 6. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So you are yourself a Zen practitioner, is that correct?
Yes, I've been a practitioner for more than 25 years, yes.
So what is Zen? We know it's a form of Buddhism, but what is it in itself?
It's basically a system of practices, more than a belief system. It's a system of practices meant to help us with overcoming the conditioned mind and attaining freedom.
And stories seem to be perhaps more in this tradition than in others, I don't know, but stories seem to play a very big role in helping people along that path.
Yeah, it's just part of the Zen tradition. It's one of the things that drew me to it. It's got a really, it's a fundamentally oral literature, although it's been written down, which is a basically the Zen canon is a compilation of encounters between teachers and students and moments of transformation, awakening, moments of wisdom. And they're often very short, pithy stories that make a point, although some of the points can be obscure.
I know, that's what I found when I was reading it. I was like, I don't understand most of these stories, which I suppose, like the tradition of the Zen koan, is kind of part of the deal.
Yeah, some of the stories are meant to more or less throw a wrench into the works of the linear mind, the conventional linear mind, the conditioned mind, and provide a glimpse of something that we don't understand or don't know, which is really what life is, not really understandable in clearly explicable terms. So it's meant to throw us into the direct experience of living, or direct experience of awareness. And when it's backed up by years and years of meditation, it's different than if you just read it and you're confused. The not knowing in Zen is a very deep state of communion with, we call it the great mystery in Zen.
I think that's one of the things that is interesting about reading this book, because there are certain stories where the student says, oh, I understand this, and then they say, wait a minute, I don't understand this at all, and the teacher says, ah, you've arrived.
Yes.
And I'm reading this going, I don't understand it either, but I don't think I've arrived.
Yeah, what happens in Zen first is we take off the layers of what we think we know. And it's a lot of people come to Zen because they want some sort of clear explanation. Why, you know, why do we live? Why do we die? What are we doing on this earth? And of course, lots of people have tried to provide explanations for these things. But life is just a direct experience of living. It doesn't really require an explanation. Zen is really more about living life very, very deeply and directly in a way that's inherently satisfying. You start to become conversant with a question, with a mystery, comfortable with a mystery. I guess the way it seems to me is the experience sometimes you have in meditation, and the experience you start to have in just living, communion with other people or with nature or with the beauty of life, you just start to think, well, I don't know what it means, but it couldn't be so beautiful if it didn't mean something.
Very interesting. Zen seems to be, for many people, associated with a practice of some kind, like archery or musical instrument making, mm-hmm. or something that is very much of a craft. What is the relationship between that kind of activity and Zen?
Well, I teach at UNM Tao, so I've been fortunate enough to be able to teach meditation there for 7 years. And I started out teaching it in connection with creativity. In fact, when I first started teaching meditation, I was assisting Natalie Goldberg in her writing workshops. So it was originally linked with writing, and then I started to branch it out to include other areas of creativity, and that's how I started teaching it at UNM Taos. What happens is, as we start to release our hold on what we think we know, we start to experience something that in Zen is called beginner's mind. It's like the mind of pure creativity or wonder. You know, it's probably the mind that any artist has to go into in order to discover something new. And it's very good for liberating the creative spirit for that reason. It's very good for letting go of our conditioned sense of what things are and how things ought to be done, and to give us the ability to discover something new. So it's another reason why I was personally drawn to Zen practices. There were such close links with the arts. You know, personally for me, I'm a novelist as well. I have 3 novels out, and it's really helped me with liberating my creative mind and also removing obstacles to that. And the common obstacle people have to creating anything new is all the voices in our heads that tell us we can't do it, or it's not worth doing, or we'll never make money at it, you know, or there's too much art already, or there's too many books already. And Zen gives you the ability to deal directly with your mind in a way that we're not dominated by our thoughts and feelings.
Then there's another part of it, man. You're talking about the creative aspect. And then there is things like karate or archery, which aren't necessarily about creativity per se, but about a kind of mastery. And it seems like there's this ongoing paradox, which is on the one hand being entirely in the new moment and having beginner's mind, mm-hmm. and on the other hand, mastering something by practicing it 40,000 times.
Yeah. Basically, the way it works in Zen is you practice it 40,000 times and then you forget it. So, and that's what happens with anybody, I think, who masters. If you look at great musicians, they practice and practice and practice and practice. But then in the moment of playing, if they start to think about what they're doing, it's not going to work. So they have to practice it to the point where it becomes second nature. And when it becomes second nature, then you've really become free.
Let's talk about the American Zen tradition. I mean, Zen is a Japanese form. I mean, Buddhism comes from India, and then it spread all over the place, and one of the places was Japan, and then it came to America. What are some of the first pieces? I mean, you have a lot of this in your book of American Zen practice.
Well, strangely, some of the first people who really took to it were the Beats in the 1950s, and I think that in the kind of, in many ways, sterile America of the 1950s, there was a counterculture beginning to form of largely of artists and poets, writers and poets, who felt somehow trapped by the sterility and kind of the post-war, arrogance of American culture and the materialism, and felt that there must be a different way, there must be a freer way to live. And they happened upon writings about Zen, particularly by a man named D.T. Suzuki, who was a Japanese scholar who almost single-handedly brought the first information on Zen to America and had a huge influence among writers, artists, intellectuals in the 1950s.
And people like John Cage and that circle.
That's right. John Cage, the composer, was really, really influenced by D.T. Suzuki. And D.T. Suzuki gave lectures at Columbia that all the Columbia University, that all the intellectuals of the day in New York would attend. It was very, very influential. And D.T. Suzuki had a way of presenting Zen that made it seem like it was completely a way of kind of reconnecting with the native beauty and exuberance of life, of living, and overcoming the sense of constraint that I think a lot of people felt in America in the 1950s. So it's interesting that intellectuals in the counterculture first picked up on it and really saw a promise of a way of liberating their minds.
And there was a woman who became a very advanced Zen practitioner during a time where women weren't even allowed into some of these zendos, especially in Japan.
Yes, Jiyu Kennett was the name of that woman who went to Japan and eventually became a Roshi, a Zen teacher in her own right, which would have been, if you imagine, not only was the role of women very oppressed both in America and Japan at the time, but it was immediate post-war. You know, this was a country we'd only been at war with 10 years before. The occupation had recently ended in Japan.
Yeah.
But it was, interestingly enough, it was that the fact of being at war with that country and the kind of cross-fertilization of cultures that in some way also created an opening. And one of the big innovations in Zen in America has been from the beginning that men and women have practiced side by side, and that those constraints that existed in Japan between male and female practitioners being separated and women not usually having teaching position or a position of authority, that immediately dissolved when it came to America. And even among the Japanese teachers who came over here, they immediately started teaching men and women equally. And so many of the prominent teachers in America now are women.
We're talking to Sean Murphy about his book, One Bird, One Stone, 108 Contemporary Zen Stories. Now, why 108?
108 is the number of beads on a mala, which is the Zen version of a rosary. Interestingly, a rosary also has 108, so it's just a...
Really?
It's a fun mystical number. It probably comes out of the number of beads on a rosary or mala may have come out of India even and gone into both Chinese, Japanese, and European culture. That's just a guess, but it's one of those mystical numbers. It's just fun to proceed from a mystical number, isn't it?
Right. Now, another characteristic of Zen seems to be that the meditation sessions are excruciatingly painful. And people go through, especially when they want to get to whatever kind of, I don't know how exactly the levels work, but when you want to get to the next step, you have to sit through these long, painful, sitting in one position, back-breaking. What's the point of pain?
Well, I don't know that there's specifically a point of pain. It's just that when you meditate for long periods, for many people find it quite difficult. But the experience of meditating for that long, the results are quite profound. So it's really, that's kind of the only way to get there. It's a bit like going on... if you were to go on pilgrimage to the Himalayas or something, it would be a long, difficult journey, but the payoff would be big. It's a bit like that. Although, of course, if you look at Native American traditions like the Sun Dance or Vision Quest or even Catholic prayer, you know, often there's some discomfort involved. It's a part of life. And in Zen, you just kind of take on life in all its many facets, and unfortunately pain is part of it, difficulty is part of it, but things that are worth achieving take a lot of effort, and Zen practice is like that. It takes a lot of effort.
And then, if I may ask, what do you get to?
You get to this, as I said before, you get to this sense of comfort with a mystery, I guess is what it is. It's in a way, sometimes you hear the spiritual journey described as a kind of a circle, that you come back to where you began. In a certain way, children, if you look at children, I'm talking about children who are treated correctly and have everything they need, they have an innate joy in life. Of course, they experience pain, but they cry, it's over, and then they go back to being excited about the next thing. if you look at animals, they're generally, if they have everything they need, they're generally on the upside of life. They're not tearing the, you don't see dogs just saying, oh, why do we live? You know, you don't see unhappy chipmunks, you know, unless they're actively suffering. You know, the native experience of being alive, if you look at animals and children before they start thinking too much, is it's definitely on the upside of down. But oftentimes as adults, we've lost touch with that. Our conditioned reality starts to overtake us. We start to walk around in a state of worry and stress. We're thinking more about what we have to get done later in the day and next week, and then we're driving by some beautiful natural scene or a beautiful sunset, you know, thinking about our shopping list. Our minds start to get very, very entangled and start to cloud the experience of living. And then we start to... our minds become like a crowded attic that's just everything stuffed in there, right? There's beautiful treasures, and then there's just a bunch of junk. And in Zen practice, we sit down and we start taking everything out of the attic. You know, we start clearing the mind. As we start clearing the mind, the natural joy and exuberance of life, the natural creative spirit of life starts to come back in.
You referred a moment ago to a happy child or a happy animal, and one of the initial stories in the book is this question of whether or not dogs have Buddha nature.
Yes.
Is there any consensus on that within Zen?
Of course they do. Yeah. Dogs have Buddha. Everything has Buddha nature, what you call the enlightened nature. Everything in some way, certainly all living things, share one life. And that's what you start to experience through Zen practice. When you start to clear out all the clutter of the mind, you start to realize the unity of all life. And you know, it's not as though, you know, a billboard somewhere starts spelling out the meaning of life to you. It's just you start to be comfortable with the fact that life does have meaning and life has great beauty and depth to it. And so in a certain way, you return to that simple joy of living that we experience if we were lucky as children.
Would you like to read one of the Zen stories?
Yes. One of the interesting things that started to happen in the 1960s is a little in the 50s and 60s, a number of teachers in the Zen tradition started to come over from the East and from Japan and also from China. This is a story about one of the Chinese Zen monks who came over in the 1960s, and his name was Dei Chun, and he moved into rural Tennessee. You can imagine what an orange-robed Chinese shaved-headed monk, what kind of a response he might get in rural Tennessee in the 1960s. Anyway, this is a story from him. The Zen monk Dei Chun lived in rural Tennessee in the 1960s and 70s, where he attracted a small but devoted group of students associated with a nearby university. When Dei Chun first came to Tennessee, there was a huge dead oak in the yard beside his cabin. One day, one of his neighbors happened by and said, "You'd better cut that thing down, or one of these days it's going to fall on your roof." "Oh, thank you," said Dei Chun. The next time he went into town, he bought a hatchet at a thrift store. He promptly set to work on the tree's enormous trunk, chopping away for some time every morning and showing no signs of discouragement at his minimal progress. Neighbors, seeing him work day after day, showed up with chainsaws and power saws, offering to help cut the tree down for him. "Thank you, no," said Dei Chun. "I'll do it my way." This went on for months with such regularity that if his neighbors didn't hear the steady chop, chop, chop of Dei Chun on his tree any given morning, they'd come over to make sure he was all right. It became a phenomenon, a cause for conversation, and before too long, the strange old Chinese fellow who'd moved in from out of nowhere had become a member of the neighborhood. On the day the tree finally fell with a crash that shook all the houses on his street, one of Dei Chun's friends asked him, "So what will you do now?" "Make firewood," answered Dei Chun. He later said this was the way he taught the meditation. You just chop away a little bit every day, and one day an enormous tree falls.
Sean Murphy from the book One Bird, One Stone, 108 Contemporary Zen Stories. So tell us about the activity, the journey, I suppose, on your part of compiling all these stories.
Yeah, I traveled all over the country speaking to more than 100 senior Zen practitioners and monks and teachers and collecting their stories or moments of wisdom. There's a tradition in well, we've seen a lot of these books published in English, translated into English, of collections of Zen stories, mostly from the East. I call them miso soups for the soul. And nobody had yet done a book like that based on Zen in America, even though Zen's been in America and there have been Zen teachers and students now for more than 50 years. So that was the nucleus of the idea. And I traveled extensively between both coasts and the center of the country, collecting stories and talking to people. It was quite an interesting journey. Yeah.
And I suppose each person gave you some word of mouth of where you might go next.
Yeah, I did a lot of research in advance, and I had gotten my MFA in writing from the Naropa Institute, which is in Boulder, Colorado. It's a contemplative college that was founded by the poet Allen Ginsberg with a somewhat renegade Tibetan lama named Chogyam Trungpa. And it's a well-known writing program, but if you go there, you're going to be exposed to a lot of meditation teachers. And so I had good connections to start with. I was already practicing with my own teacher. His name was John Dado Lurie, who founded a monastery called Zen Mountain Monastery in upstate New York near Woodstock. And I'd already heard a number of good stories. So I had a nucleus of good ideas and did my research. And people in the Zen tradition can sometimes be suspicious of people coming in and wanting to make a story out of what they do. So some of the stories in the book took a little work to get out of people. Sometimes people would really, certain teachers are not in the habit of talking to the press. Sometimes they would really challenge me until they saw that I was sincere before really giving me the story. There's a few stories of encounters in the book where I had quite a long encounter. There's one with a local teacher named Kobenchino Roshi, who taught in Taos for many years. So we've got about a 6 or 7 page story of a whole encounter with him that ended with a refusal to do an interview with me, which is very Zen in its way. You know, Zen is one of the things that charms me about it is just like the story we just read about Dai Chun, there's an eccentric way of doing things that's nonetheless wise, and sometimes in a kind of backwards fashion. But it's in a way that maybe makes your eyes open up or your ears perk up and might make you pay attention in a new way.
You live in Taos, is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
And there is a teacher training for meditation teachers coming up. And I'd never heard of that. I know there's yoga teacher trainings and things like that. Are you teaching this yourself?
Yes, I founded it with a nonprofit organization called the Sage Institute for Creativity, Consciousness, and the Environment. The website is sagetaos.com. And we started to realize that if you wanted to learn meditation in the way that we're able to learn yoga now, which is in a secular way, you can go to any gym and take a yoga class, and it won't necessarily seem culturally strange to you. But with all the press that meditation is getting these days, it's still difficult to find a place to study meditation without having to go to a Zen center or a Vipassana meditation center or a Tibetan center or something that might look a little culturally strange to your average American. So we decided to start a meditation teacher's training program for a certificate similar to what yoga teachers now go through, because something like that didn't exactly exist before. And I've been training now in Zen for 25 years, teaching at the university meditation, secular meditation, for 7 years. And I've gotten, through doing the book and through years of teaching, I've gotten very well connected among meditation teachers. So my Zen lineage, which is the White Plum lineage of Zen, it's the largest one in the United States, is very much behind this initiative to start a meditation teachers training program. So yes, we're starting this summer to teach our first batch of meditation teachers.
Very interesting. Sean Murphy is the author of One Bird, One Stone, 108 Contemporary Zen Stories, and you will be reading tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe.
That's right. Looking forward to it.
Well, we look forward to seeing you there, and thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.